Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth, best-selling author and co-creator of PaleoParents.com, where we focus on real-life solutions for families seeking health.
I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne, New York Times best-selling author and creator of ThePaleoMom.com. I'm passionate about improving scientific literacy around public health topics.
I like hashtags and bone broth.
And I'm just a super nerd.
Welcome back to the Paleo View, everyone. And as promised, we do have a special guest this week.
We do!
It's not often that we have guests on the podcast anymore, but I am super excited that Diana Rogers, who is, I think, maybe trying to go for like MVP, most frequent podcast guest, has joined us. Diana's been on the show several times before. You may recognize her blog, Sustainable Dish, and we did a show with her years ago talking about my digestive health, because she also runs a nutritional practice. But I'm super excited to have you on the show this week, Diana, because you've been working on a special project that I think our listeners will be jazz hands excited to hear about.
Oh, you made me do jazz hands just by saying jazz hands.
I did it too.
Right now. Oh, man. We do a lot of jazz hands on the show whenever we can. That's our goal.
Do you want me to just launch into it?
Tell everyone about the project. Because Stacey,
yeah. Make sure you're doing jazz hands as
frequently as possible.
Nice. Thank you so much for having me back. I actually get the most pingbacks to me from being on your show. Like, I've had the most client referrals and just, you know, messages and stuff. So
that's because our listeners are the best podcast listeners.
They're certainly the most engaged of most of the podcasts that I've been on. So I appreciate
that. They are very, very, very fine folk.
Yeah. So for folks who don't know much about me, I am a dietitian. I did a career switch. I was in natural foods marketing for a while and then helped out on the farm. I live on an organic farm with my husband and two kids. And once I had our second child, it just was too crazy to have a corporate marketing job. And so I started working on the farm doing all of our CSA, our vegetable CSA membership stuff. I ran our farm stand. We had a kitchen. I kind of did all the marketing and events and weddings, kind of all the front of the house stuff at the farm. And we were hosting a raw milk co-op. And I was like, who are these crazy people who are coming here and getting these jugs of milk and spending like $12 for this crazy milk that has all this fat in it? This is the silliest thing I've ever heard of.
How long ago was this?
Was maybe 2008. So maybe 2006.
Times have changed.
Yeah. Maybe 2006. I'm trying to remember. Yeah, no, actually it was a little bit before that, because my first Weston A. Price conference was 2008. So this was, maybe I just dipped my toes in it like 2005, 2006. And so I started learning a little bit more. I started actually eating butter. I had to hear it like 100 times before I would actually eat butter. And I was already on a gluten-free diet because I had found out I diagnosed celiac at age 26, but I was just doing sort of this low fat, you know, mostly vegetarian, like lots of lentils and tofu and high carb gluten-free diet. But lo and behold, once I added more fat in, I didn't have gestational diabetes with my second child. And then once I started going to these Weston A. Price conferences, I was like, oh my gosh, these guys are really onto something. How can I get more involved? I kept getting all these questions and didn't really know how to answer them right about, you know, why are we selling coconut oil and lard at the farm stand? Aren't those bad for you? And I knew they were working for me, but I didn't really have a good, you know, solid response on why fat was good for you. And so I decided to attend Nutritional Therapy Association and got my NTP, I became a nutritional therapy practitioner, but then quickly realized that in order to really change my career and take insurance and do medical nutrition therapy, I needed my RD. So then I went back to school and got my RD and did that part-time with kids. And it took me about 6 years. And I think I came on the podcast right when I was celebrating. I have probably had a large bottle of wine next to me there. And so ever since I got the RD and, you know, from all my experience living on the farm, I've really started focusing more, you know, in addition to my, you know, clinical practice where I take insurance and help people mostly with IBS type things and metabolic type stuff. I'm really, really passionate about the intersection of sustainability and human nutrition. Like what are the best foods for us that are also the most sustainable? What are the most sustainable foods and are they healthy for us? And it turns out that there's a really huge Venn diagram and it sort of perfectly meshes with, you know, the foods that we grow on our farm happen to be also the most nutrient dense and healthiest ones. And lately in particular, I'm most interested in defending meat. So there's a lot going on in the anti-meat world. I live in a town outside of Boston where a lot of, you know, there's a lot of educated people here. Nobody eats red meat. They're super scared of it. They think that, you know, it's bad for the environment and it's going to give them cancer. And so they're all eating chicken, which is actually really hard to find a good pasture-raised chicken. You can find grass-fed beef even at Walmart these days, but pastured chicken is still, you know, I'm all for it, but it's hard to source. And so I'm really curious about diving into that more. And I've decided to start a film project called Kale versus Cow, The Case for Better Meat. I'm all for all animal proteins, but I'm really honing in on cows because they're the most vilified. Like if you picture those vegan hierarchies, you know, like some people call themselves a vegetarian when they don't eat red meat, but they'll still eat chicken and fish, you know, chicken and fish are seen as cleaner meats than red meat. And why is that? It's absolutely life, you know, any different or more important or less important than a chicken, than a fish, you know, and then even going up the hierarchy than a tree. Right. And when red meat is one of the most nutrient dense foods there are. So I'm going to be looking at all the sort of nutrition misconceptions we have about red meat from the fat and the cancer and kind of all that stuff. I'll be looking at the environmental impact of well-raised cattle and how they can actually help sequester carbon. And then I'm also diving into the ethical piece, which is super, you know, treacherous waters, as I'm probably going to get a lot of flack for this. But, you know, when you really think about trying to cause least harm through your diet, is it really causing least harm to eat only plants? When we think about, you know, how irrigation and monocropping and GMOs and chemical fertilizer, all that kind of stuff compared to, you know, how many people can one grass-fed cow who's increasing biodiversity and sequestering carbon, you know, that's nearly 500 pounds of incredibly nutrient-dense meat from that animal. And so so that's basically it. And we're going to be doing some storytelling. I'm sure, you know, we can dive into any one of these numerous rabbit holes with you guys on the show, but that's the film in a nutshell.
I, as you know, happen to be incredibly passionate about this as well, because mm-hmm. I was a vegetarian for 7 years. And the only reason that I felt comfortable coming back into being a meat eater was to do it sustainably, to support animals being raised ethically and humanely, and utilizing whole animal and helping the earth with treating them properly and good farming practices and that kind of stuff. So there have been countless topics on this podcast because I wrote a book about pastured pork beyond bacon mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's, you know, one of the things that always gets me about particularly Americans loving chicken mm-hmm. is that as a vegetarian, you know, it was like I thought eating chicken and fish was somehow better than eating pork or cows. But now that I'm on the other side of it, I'm like, wait, I can get so many more meals from one life. Like, not just to mention all of the science and the crops and all that kind of stuff, which I know Sarah's going to want to sink her teeth into, because we've tangentially talked about that. But I think what's fascinating for me is, even just from the perspective of, you know, if you care about life and you don't want to take a life, you can get so much more out of one life from a cow or a pig or even a goat than you could a chicken or a fish. Mm-hmm. So I am extremely passionate about this. So before we jump into all of these rabbit holes, though, I think it would be good. So you're working on this project in particular. Maybe give a little more specific details. Like, you're working on a campaign right now to help fund this coming to fruition, right?
I am. Yes. I have a link. I'm direct linking to my generosity.com fundraiser through my website. So folks can find it through sustainabledish.com/ What is it? /film. And, so I've got all kinds of fun perks on there, and folks can see, all the companies that have endorsed me there, and they can watch the little video that I did, and they can see me on my farm with my family, and read a lot more about the approach that we're taking, all there on that page. So it's sustainabledish.com/film.
And I think it's important to sort of emphasize that there have been a number of crowdsourced documentaries recently, like a particular one that has most of the paleo community feeling.
Very, you mean the one that ends in a word that rhymes with smelt?
Yeah. Yeah.
The one that encourages the opposite of what its title is. Yeah.
Right.
So I decided to tackle this because I've really had enough of these vegan propaganda films. They're showing them at high schools. They have shown them at our local high school here, and they're full of incredibly biased and illogical conclusions, misinformation. I mean, saying that meat causes diabetes is, I mean, I can't even believe the FDA like allowed these films to happen. And I'm really disturbed that they're showing them in schools. There's also a couple of schools in the Brooklyn area that have gone vegetarian with the, you know, secret agenda of the organization behind it pushing them towards vegan. And it's all stemming from this one organization that has this very sort of vanilla name, like, you know, the Healthy Foods Coalition or something silly like that. Or not silly, but very, you know,
It doesn't sound
like they're, you know, trying to push for veganism. But then you go to their site, you can get free posters saying peace on a plate, with a plate with all vegetables on it, you know, explaining how, you know, no animals were harmed for your meal. And that should have no business being in a public school, right? Like that to me is like a religious message. So to impose those moral codes on young people and impressioning them with, you know, meat is bad at such a young age, and to really be attacking meat instead of, like, the obvious thing is processed food here, everybody. It's really, really disturbing to me. There's another organization that's similar to that, that's sending free textbooks to medical schools. Any medical school that wants them can get one of these books, and they're vegan nutrition textbooks. So they're sort of like, oh, we're just out here doing good. And it's like, no, they're actually spreading this message. This anti-meat message is making its way up into our dietary guidelines. It's actually, I just got an email from a farmer friend of mine. It's affecting her sales at farmers markets, because now in Massachusetts, you can get SNAP credits for, you know, you can go and buy your produce at the farmer's market. With, you get like double your produce if you go to a farmer's market, support local farmers. But they're not doing that with meat, and it's actually hurting the meat vendors. But, you know, it's this whole idea that meat is bad. Let's not support, you know, we can allow organic vegetable sales, but we can't allow local meat sales. So this kind of stuff really bothers me, and it really infiltrates worldwide human nutrition, because everyone wants to follow America, right? And all these cultures are giving up their traditional foods and going with American Western foods. It's a sign that you've made it when you can eat, you know, Western processed crap. And so we're ruining the lives of our own people and everyone else on the planet. And not only our everyone's health, but we're also ruining the soils and our ability to make food in the future.
Okay, so that's where I want to go with this conversation, because I think that, you know, with our audience, I think is very well in tuned with the whole idea of there's nutrition that we get from plant foods that we can't get from animal foods, and nutrition that we get from animal foods that we can't get from plant foods. Humans are inherently omnivores, and we need to be eating both plant foods and animal foods in order to get balanced nutrition. And I think our listeners are fairly in tune with that, but I want to empower people, I think, with some discussion points to have with people in their lives who are maybe saying, oh, well, I'm going to try this plant-based diet, or I'm going to try vegan, or whatever it is. And I want to use you to fact check something. So I'm totally putting you on the spot right now. But Lear Keith, she wrote The Vegetarian Myth, which is usually a book that I recommend to people as there's a lot of harm being done by grain-based diets and vegan diets are nutritionally deficient, and here's a great book to read on that subject. But she has a statistic that is, if you take an acre of land and you monocrop it and you grow corn for animal feed and you have no other plant species on that land can't support any insects or birds or other kind of life. The soil is treated and being depleted, so it doesn't have the diversity of bacteria. So you're really destroying the topsoil. You've got fertilizer and pesticides that are leaching into the water, and you don't have any kind of biodiversity on that land. And with that 1 acre of corn, you can truck to a factory farm and you can feed 2 cows for 1 year. And if you take that same acre of land and you restore it to its natural habitat, where it's got grass and scrub trees and birds and insects, and you've got a healthy topsoil with lots of bacteria in that soil, and you have grass-fed, you know, free-range cattle on that 1 acre of land, you can feed 2 cows for 1 year. And this is one of, I think, one of her most compelling arguments for not just grass-fed meat, but also how terrible factory farming is, and how terrible industrial farming is, and how it's leaching topsoil. But I've never been able to sort of fact check the actual, like, is it really equivalent? Is it really that 1 acre feeds the same number of cows for the same amount of time?
Yeah. So that is a really tricky question, because are we talking about an acre at Joel Salatin's farm where he's built it up and it's amazing and super productive? Are we talking about Nevada where it's like pretty brittle environment? They don't get a lot of rain. So it's hard, but I did ask Joel what his numbers were on his farm. And it sounds like it's about, and then he gets into, well, you have to have a mom to have a baby, and you know what I mean? So there's a lot more than just like, can I grow a cow? Because you have to also get a mom pregnant, and then they have a higher nutritional need, and then you're not gonna, you know, you're gonna harvest the baby, you're not gonna harvest the mom. And so it's a calf-cow situation. So there's that. But yes, it's about 2 cows per acre on a pretty productive, intensive grazing situation. But there's a little more to it than that too, because the important thing to know is there's a really big difference between pasture land and croppable land. So if you look at all the agricultural land available on the globe, on the land of the world, most of it is actually not suitable for corn or soy or wheat because it's either too hilly or, you know, poor irrigation or whatever, bad soils. So, I mean, just picture Iceland, right? You can't grow, it's too cold. Norway, you can't really grow much there. Most of Africa is pretty inhospitable to, you know, water demanding crops. So, you know, we Americans, we picture that you can just grow crops anywhere, but it's actually not the case at all. So that's why, like in Mongolia, they're herding people with animals because they can't really crop Mongolia, right? Like you can't, you can't have like big lush farms there because the climate just doesn't work for it. But you can graze animals on most land. So there's a lot more pasture land than there is croppable land. So if we were to just eliminate all animals and only go with crops, we'd actually be way reducing our land availability to grow food. Does this make sense? So,
yeah.
So when they say, oh, cows take up, you know, 50 acres of land compared to how much you can get off corn. Well, it's like, you're not really comparing, it's not fair to compare pasture land to cropland because cows don't need to compete with crops. 85% of the cows that are grown or raised in America are grazing on land that we can't crop anyway. So it's really like we're not really comparing apples to apples. And if you think about the whole Midwest, it was actually really grasslands. It's really pasture land. It shouldn't be cropped. And that's one of the reasons the Dust Bowl happened, is because we cropped it, we eroded the topsoil, we've ruined it. It should be in pasture. It should not be cropped. That's a rabbit hole that I warned you that.
So many, yes. No, and I feel like I have like 7 follow-up questions.
Yeah.
I really want to dig into this idea that a plant-based diet can do more harm than good, not just from a nutritional perspective, but more from the sustainability environmental perspective. And I just kind of want to give you the opportunity to dig into that subject a little bit more.
Definitely.
So beyond the fact that we would be limiting our ability to grow, you know, calories and nutrition if we globally switch to a plant-based diet, what are some other implications of sort of abandoning meat as a nutrition source from a environmental and sustainability perspective?
There was just a really great paper that came out last week that I could send to you guys, and it looked at the nutrition, which was fascinating, but also the environmental implications of eliminating meat. So Sarah, you'd be actually really interested in the nutritional.
Yeah, sounds like I would totally geek out over
so
that.
So we would have excessive overall calories, we would have excessive carbohydrates, and we would have nutrient deficiencies in B12 and a gazillion more nutrients. So just on a population nutrition level, it would be catastrophic. And that was the main conclusion of the paper. But then they did look at the environmental impact of eliminating animals. And even with eliminating factory farming, the total greenhouse gas reduction, it was only a couple percentage points. It's greenhouse gas emissions is not really that big of a problem with animal farming. When we look at crop farming, I mean, you kind of rattled off like a lot of the issues. So we've got water misuse. We've got in California, there's a really great documentary called Water and Power, a California Heist. And it talks about, you know, the palm juice company that was really popular a few years back, and they have those bottles that are shaped like an hourglass. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That company is the Wonderful Company, and they also own basically all the pistachio production, like in California. They monopolize it. And they also happen to own a lot. This private company owns water rights in some aquifers that are underneath California that actually end up feeding like most of the major cities in Southern California. And there are whole towns of people that do not have drinking water because this company has stuck their straw into the aquifers, sucked it up, and they're irrigating their pistachios with human drinking water. Whoa. So when we think of like least harm, it's like least harm to who? Are we really like trying to save, you know, the pretty cows that look like our pets in, you know, and then like not allowing people to have drinking water? And when we're diverting rivers in order to have irrigation, what happens to the fish in those rivers, the animals that depend on that fish for food? You know, I mean, the list just goes on and on. When we have runoff, you know, it's not just, oh, it's pollution. It's actually killing, you know, the fish in the waters. I mean, we've got a whole entire dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico from cropping agriculture. This isn't factory farming here. This is crop agriculture that we've done. And when we use chemical fertilizers, I mean, the earth is not an endless resource. It doesn't just like keep spewing out resources. Things do dry up. And so we're not going to have all the minerals and all the chemicals that we need in order to continue to have exponential growth in our productivity with cropping. It's going to die off, and it is dying off. And so we're going to have huge problems. And if we don't start looking more at natural cycles, at the ability to harness the sun's power and grow grass that cows can eat on land that we can't crop anyway, then we're going to be in really big trouble. And so that's why I'm particularly disturbed by lab meats and like indoor farming, is because it's the exact opposite of the way nature works. And it's the exact opposite of just using sun directly to grow food. So, and not even to mention the human issue of like, who's harvesting your food. I never hear people talk about that. You know, like there are child laborers here that are being mistreated in America, harvesting our tomatoes. And, you know, but you know, it's very easy to draw a line and say, well, plants are good and animals are bad, and to not really dive into all of the harm that comes from a plant-based diet.
One of the things that you mentioned was the greenhouse gas emissions. Mm-hmm. And I wanted you to kind of expand on that a little bit, because that's one of the, you know, one of the... One of the arguments or discussions that I will get into with family members who don't want to eat red meat is about, oh, well, you know, cows produce so much methane through their cow farts, mm-hmm. And that's contributing to global warming. And so we need to reduce the cow population in order to reduce the impact on the environment. And so I kind of want to give you that, like, let's dig into that a little bit more, because that's one of those like frustrating arguments that I have.
Definitely. So when they're just measuring cow farts, it's really reductionism. They're looking at just, you know, what cows put out. And it's like the other studies when they're looking at, well, cows drink a lot of water. Okay, but they also pee a lot too. Like, they're not just like exploding balloons, right? That we're and so there's this whole other cycle that happens when a cow is managed well on grass, that they actually sequester carbon. And there's been lots of studies coming out recently about how cows are actually a net gain for carbon, that they're one of our best chances at storing carbon and reducing climate change. And so what we have to do is look at the entire cycle and not just measure farts, because that's, you're not going to get anywhere measuring farts, right? and so, you know, when we think about what the grasslands were before the settlers came to America, it was largely bison. And actually, when you add up all the bison plus all the other deer and antelope and all the other animals that were, well, I don't know if there were antelope in North America, but deer and other ruminants that were roaming around on North America, it added up to a lot more animals than we have today. Mm. And so, you know, they were also farting as well. I'm sure they farted too.
And that was the end of the Ice Age, right? No,
We hunted them all out. We turned it into crop. And what happened? The Dust Bowl. What happened? You know, we started processing food and we all got sick when, you know, we could just be eating more grass-fed meat and be healthy.
Right.
So cows can actually help sequester carbon. It's, there's a couple of different ways that this happens. They're chomping on the grass actually stimulates the grass to grow. And their manure is actually not waste at all. It's fertilizer for the soil. There's all kinds of great bacteria in cow poop that inoculates the soil with really important bacteria that it needs to feed the roots. So the roots have the symbiotic relationship with the bacteria in the soil. When the cow chomps on it, that stimulates the roots to grow. The bacteria are actually fed carbohydrates from the plant. So through photosynthesis, the plant creates carbon into its roots that it drips out to the bacteria. The bacteria in turn then feed the roots with all the different nutrients it needs, and it works with the fungal network to mine minerals. It's a really amazing process. And when cows are on the same patch of land day in and day out, that's when we start to have problems. Then they can overgraze. They overgraze their favorite grasses, allowing for the not so great, you know, species to take over. Parasites can get out of control. It's a bad system. But when the cows are rotated and constantly moved, like the herds of bison were moving, the grass has a chance to rest and recover. And that's when all the magic happens. That's when the carbon sequestration happens. And they're measuring this now. And it's amazing what's happening. So it's all about the management. So it's not the cow, it's how it's managed.
How big of a hurdle is it to switch from this predominantly factory farming model producing most of the meat in America to these sort of grazing rotation models? Like, even if those cows are still supplemented with food, like not necessarily being purely grass fed and grass finished, mm-hmm. but like mm-hmm. switching to this model that's much more environmentally friendly. How big of a hurdle is that?
Yeah. So a lot of people think that cows are raised on a feedlot their whole lives. They live on a feedlot forever. And it's actually not true. Even a typical cow is grazing on land that we can't grow crops on. And then at the end, it's finished on a feedlot. So they don't really start baby cows on feedlots. So even a typical cow, I would argue, is a much better choice than your typical chicken or pork, because those animals are spending their entire lives indoors in CAFOs under fluorescent lights eating 100% grain. Oh. So that was something that was really cool for me to discover, and people tend to be really kind of surprised when they hear that. To make the switch over to this kind of grazing technique, you do need a little bit more land access. And again, it's not land that we have to be cropping, so it doesn't need to compete with us for, you know, our kale and other things that we like to crop. It's more of a demand issue. And if ranchers and other, you know, producers realize that there's consumers that are out there that want this product and are willing to pay them for the time that it takes them to raise it this way, they will produce it. That's just how economics works.
So we could literally just take this piece of the puzzle out where, like, cows are moved to a feedlot to fatten up for the last couple months of their lives.
We could, and I'm not 100% against all, like, finishing. I know that, I personally eat all grass-fed, but I think I have seen systems where, you know, they're finished on some grains, and it's not what you might be picturing from some of the documentaries that are out there. It's actually not, like, this horrific situation, right? It's just a little more visible because we can drive by bad feedlots and we don't tend to drive by pork CAFOs and chicken CAFOs and see on the inside. And so that's why people are so like, oh my God, feedlot beef. But yes, cows were meant to eat grass. That's what they eat. And same with sheep as well. So it's not just cows, you know, bison, are great. Lamb is great. Goats are great. You know, there's lots of ruminants who can also do the same thing. I'm just sort of honing in on cows because beef is just such a hot topic right now.
Yeah. And the same arguments basically apply to all ruminants. What about pigs? Like pigs are naturally mm-hmm. omnivores. Mm-hmm. If you look at a pasture model for pigs, does that also have the same sort of benefits from an environmental standpoint? I mean, obviously it's better in terms of humanely raising that meat and mm-hmm. ethical treatment of the animals. And there are studies that definitely show that pasture-raised pork has more nutrients than feedlot or factory farmed pig, CAFO mm-hmm. pig. But can you make the same arguments from an environmental standpoint? Like they're sequestering carbon. I would imagine they're still adding to topsoil and biodiversity and things like that by doing, you know, pooping.
Sort of. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely better to raise them outdoors. They don't have the same impact on land that cows do. Pigs can be quite destructive we use them on our farm to clear land, right? Like they kind of go in, we run them through the woods and they get rid of all the brush and they'll leave the big trees, but pretty much everything else is gone.
Do they eat it or do they like trample it?
They do this thing called rooting where they basically, they'll eat all the like poison ivy and all the other like brush that's in the woods here in Massachusetts. I know. Goats are awesome at that too. And then they will, they do this thing called rooting where they, I've Instagrammed it actually, where they kind of bury their heads down. They'll find the roots. I mean, the roots are rich in carbohydrates. And so they're chomping on all that stuff. They love to eat tree roots and other roots. And so what's left after we've had a bunch of pigs running through the woods is really pretty woods, right? Like you like walk through them and it's just like the land is pretty clear. So, you know, I mean, pigs initially were part of human culture because they ate our kitchen scraps. And so that's kind of like everyone had like a pig and a few chickens and they ate our food scraps. But now it's illegal to feed pigs food scraps. Unless you like process it and sanitize it all like right on site in these like very specific ways. And so make it pretty difficult.
Is that local or national law? Like where does that come from?
It might be a national law here. I know they're trying to reverse it in England right now. There's like a big or pro food waste to pigs, you know, like there's companies that are trying to make, you know, process leftover, restaurant food and like cook it down and pasteurize it and then give it to farmers for pig food. It should be. I mean, that should be totally how we get rid of our, you know, it makes sense.
The other thing too is I know that there are a lot of farmers that do food farming. So like in your case, when the orchard apples, mm-hmm. whatever, fall to the ground and you can't sell them because they're bruised or they're overripe or whatever it is, like pigs love that. And
oh yeah, totally. Yep. And they actually on our farm too, they get all the vegetable seconds from, you know, like the broccoli that's maybe a little bit too old for us to sell. The pigs way prefer that to grain. We do feed our pigs organic soy-free grain on our farm just because we don't have that much natural food for them in the woods. There's just not that much here. I do know in warmer areas, like down where you guys are, there are people that are doing 100% pasture-raised pigs. It's just for us where we are with the land that we have, it's not possible. But pigs are pretty efficient at converting grain to flesh, and they actually, their stomachs, they're monogastric. They can actually handle grain. Like it doesn't make them sick like it makes a cow sick. So it's a little bit of a different model there. Yeah. Same with chickens. Oh, I was going to say same with chickens too. Like chickens, actually birds eat seeds.
It's more native to their natural diet.
Right? It's a more biologically appropriate nutrition source for them, right?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it's been, obviously I don't know as much about chickens and beef as I do about pork, but, I do think that it's, you know, kind of eye-opening for people to realize that it's healthier for the animals, it's healthier for the earth, and it's healthier for them. That's why humans have survived this way in harmony for so long without the strain on all of those different ecosystems and our own lives and health as we have introduced into the modern agriculture culture. And I think, you know, for me, it was like I had that eye-opening aha moment when I started thinking about how agriculture affected human health from the very first moment that I read the paleo diet, like a long, almost a decade ago at this point, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and so for me, it's such a full circle thing to see that it's almost like there was this interest in paleo, but there was only like this fringe movement of people who really understood the importance of the lifestyle factors and how and why pasture raised animals were a component of that lifestyle. And we haven't even talked about, you know, what we've delved into many times before when you're talking about like omega-3 and omega-6 ratio and how that affects your health and inflammation and blah, 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 right? Like we've covered all that information before. And I think what's fascinating to me is that there's a large group of people that often do paleo for like 30 days and it's like this reset for them and then they go back to their life. And that's never what, at least my perception of paleo was ever supposed to be, right? It's a lifestyle to help reduce your inflammation and help you be healthy. And here's this other facet of it that is also a long-term benefit. And it's interesting because the word Sarah and I use about paleo is we want it to be sustainable for people. And that's what your blog is, you know, the main word, because we want to make sure that someone is setting themselves up in a way that can be sustained long-term. It's not going to give you the health benefits for 30 days and then you turn it off and you go back to, you know, your pizza buffet and your bagel breakfast and, you know, everything's great again. There are serious long-term consequences to our earth and our environment and our own health when we don't take these things into consideration. So I guess maybe if you could recap for us what you think, like the main themes of this documentary of sorts that you're working on, and how people could help you bring it to fruition so that these messages could be shared with a broader audience.
Yeah. So thank you. You reminded me that I needed to stress the main big point, which you kind of summed up really nicely there. We are nature. We're not separate from nature. We are part of the food system. We are integrantly, you know, important, and all things are important, right? All the insects are important. All the mammals are important. We're causing major mass extinctions right now by our impact on the earth. It's totally wrong. And I don't think that you can truly embrace the paleo lifestyle without getting this. Like anyone who truly gets it, gets paleo, inherently should understand all these things that I'm talking about too. So thank you for reminding me that. I think the main message of the film, we can't allow the, you know, anti-meat message to be taught in schools. It's not okay because meat is incredibly nutrient dense. It's very natural for people to be eating. And we don't want to be turning young people off from meat. It's just not the right message. And yeah, so basically it's processed food. We all know this stuff. It's processed food is the real villain here, not meat. And this is just, you know, to me, it's the most important thing. Like once you've fixed your health, now it's time to really look at the whole food system and try to do something about it. And there's really no one else out there that's saying any of this stuff. So, yeah, I guess that that's the, well, I can't think of anything else to add to that. Yeah. The campaign's going on, sustainabledish.com/film. What we're trying to do right now is raise enough money to make a sizzle reel to show at Expo West. Applegate is going to be sponsoring us to come to Expo West. They've given us a portion of the money that we need in order to get there, but we need the rest of the community to help us. And it's really great that Applegate is stepping up to the plate here. They're going to be having us on a panel about the nutrition and environmental benefits of meat. With our sizzle reel, we're then going to be able to go after funding and really turn this into a feature film.
Oh, fun. So I'll remind people that the campaign is through mygenerosity.com, but you can link to it at, make sure I got this right, sustainabledish.com/film.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Sustainabledish.com/film.
Sustainabledish.com/film. And they can get updates too on my Instagram. I'm pretty active on Instagram. So it's.
I found the pig video pretty easily. So
I happen to say, Dana, your Instagram is one of my favorite to follow. Because even if you're just want pretty pictures of farm life, like, which is something I'm into.
Thank you.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much again for joining us on the Paleo View. And I have to say, listeners, I'm very proud of you that Diana thinks that you're the best of all the podcast listeners. I happen to think the same, but when our guests come on and say that, it's true. So thank you for being here week after week. If you'd like to continue to support the podcast, please don't forget to refer your friends, leave reviews, comment and engage on social media, and visit our blogs, sustainabledish.com for Miss Diana Rogers, who not only is a farm expert, but also, as she noted, a dietitian and NTP. And then thepaleomom.com and Real Everything. So you can find all kinds of information, get links to the show notes, anything that you're looking for on our blogs.
And thanks again, Diana, for joining us this week. I really enjoyed this conversation. I know all of our listeners did. And listeners, we'll be back next week.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Paleo View. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate us on iTunes. You can also support us by shopping for our favorite paleo products on the sidebars of our individual websites or by donating through PayPal.